Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's a weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and all things lifestyle.
You have quite a raspy voice this morning, Len.
I still do. Well, you should have heard me on Saturday. I would have sounded like this. Yeah, I completely lost it. But, you know, maybe it's a sign to stop talking so much.
I wouldn't go too far.
Okay.
Let's not get carried away.
Let's not. I have a lot of talking to do, or at least listening in this hour. So good morning to you, Tim Henney. Today in the program, we speak with evolutionary biologist, paleontologist, science communicator, and advocate for connecting with nature, Scott Sampson. We're so happy to say that he'll be in town next week for the Summit Land Conservancy Breakfast. That's on Wednesday, a week from today, May 11th. We hope you'll listen to this interview and get excited about listening to Scott speak next week at Deer Valley.
Then we peek at the Cycling Chicks Fashion Show with Debbie Drain.
And finally, it's Mark Wolin. He is the author of the book, It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. This is all part of May as the Mental Health Awareness Month. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these words from our underwriters.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, KPCW supporter, providing personalized knee and shoulder care, focusing on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing, and now incorporating stem cell therapy. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Support for KPCW comes from Squatter's new Squasatch Hoppy Pilsner, available at Squatter's or Wasatch Brew Pub. Squatter's, over 25 years of brewing craft beers. Good for what ails you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, next week on Wednesday, May 11th, around breakfast time, the Summit Land Conservancy will host its conservation breakfast. It's also hosted by Deer Valley Resort. They'll unite with fellow community members dedicated to preserving open spaces in Summit County. Thanks to a grant from the Vail Epic Promise, they'll be able to feature our next guest, Scott Sampson. He'll be coming to town. He's the author of the book, How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. Sampson is a passionate advocate for connecting people with nature. He serves as Vice President of Research and Collections and is the Chief Curator at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. He's also a host and science advisor for the PBS Kids television series, Dinosaur Train. We're so happy he could join us by phone to preview his talk. Scott Sampson, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's so nice and to have you, and I don't know if you remember this, but about, closing in on 3 years ago, you joined us on one of our shows to talk about how you were like the lead field guide for here in Utah in the Escalante Grand Staircase National Monument, you were unearthing the Nazutoceratops. And you were so great to hear from, to talk about. Well, now it all makes sense to me because, you know, it starts off with your love of nature and the fact that you sort of became a mini paleontologist at age 4, I remember you saying.
Yeah, paleontology is one of the first words I learned how to spell. There was actually a brief period in my life where I could reliably spell the word paleontology and not my last name.
I love that. And so, you know, you got me excited about the field of paleontology, and you didn't have to get me excited about going out in nature. But talk a little bit about the origins of, you know, maybe it starts with you digging around in the sand with your little brush, I'm picturing, to that you connected with nature and why you think it's so important.
Well, certainly for me, time spent outdoors was critical to my eventually becoming a scientist. And I have spoken with hundreds of scientists, and the story is very, very similar, that we kids' curiosity was sparked, and that curiosity stuck, and they ended up pursuing some career related to science. So I think that time outdoors really is essential to helping to foster that lifelong curiosity.
Mm. Now, we don't want to spoil what you're going to talk about a week from today with the Summit Land Conservancy breakfast at Deer Valley. We know that you will be speaking about your new book, How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. We'll sort of get people excited about, you know, having you here in Park City. I think it's pretty exciting. You actually used to be at the Utah Natural History Museum and the University of Utah. Isn't that right?
Yes. For about 7-8 years, I was involved in the sort of the reinvention of that museum, moving from its small site on the university campus to its beautiful new location just off campus.
Hey, Scott, you know, your experience as a paleontologist, you've looked at the past to try to create a narrative for the future. And I know that that's, you know, what you, well, I think that's what you believe is one of the critical components of what paleontology can bring to the field of science and, you know, looking at where we might be headed in the future. And it occurs to me, and I don't agree with this, but I'm going to throw it out there just to kind of open this conversation, that basing things on the past to predict the future has pitfalls. The future is undetermined, and we can get a glimpse or an idea, maybe if we're lucky. But to use my experience with immersion in nature, your experience with immersion in nature, to connect that to sparking creativity, couldn't you make a case that in today's world, the new millennials are sparking their creativity in other ways, and it might not necessarily have to be connected to an immersion or an exposure to nature?
Really interesting question, Tim. And I think the answer to that comes through a multitude of studies that have been published, most of them in the last 15 to 20 years, that show the impacts of leading an indoor lifestyle. So the average child today in the U.S. spends about 7 to 10 hours every day looking at screens and about 7 minutes playing outdoors, which is 90% less outdoor time than their parents had. And on the one hand, you might say, well, who cares? We're more of a technological world right now. But it does have huge impacts. We now are facing skyrocketing rates of obesity, attention deficit disorder, diabetes, depression, even conditions like myopia that just weren't nearly as prevalent or occurring nearly as young in age in children a generation ago. And this led one U.S. Surgeon General to say a few years ago that this generation of kids growing up today could be the first to have a life expectancy shorter than that of their parents. So there is this indoor migration, which has had a huge effect on the health of kids. I would flip it over and say it's also critical to the health of the places we live. Why on earth is anyone going to become sustainable unless they care about where they live? And why are they going to care unless they spend time outside connecting with that place? So that's just relating to health. If your question is purely about creativity, there's actually some really great studies to show that kids are far more creative, for example, in a natural outdoor playground than they are in an indoor or a standard metal and plastic play area, that in those kinds of situations, or if they're playing games on a computer, they're typically not as creative because somebody's already done the creativity for them. They've created this game, and there's rules to follow. They've made a slide or a swing, and there's a way to use that. Whereas when you're out in nature playing, you can use a stick in an infinite number of ways to play a game, and this is where kids' imaginations get going. Kids tend to be more imaginative, more creative, more collaborative. They bully less, all these things, if they're actually playing in outdoor settings.
And I completely agree with all of that, but I've also learned as a parent who's raised two children that things that I have held as firm foundational beliefs of my own didn't necessarily 5, 10, and 15 years later hold up through experience. And what I'm saying is that maybe this is part of an evolutionary sequence that we don't understand and we're trying to make sense of. And it's kind of that whole alchemist story, you know, of you don't know where you are in the journey, but you're in some journey that's leading you somewhere that's really hard to predict. So I just see, you know, I'm, as I said, I agree with you. I grew up in nature. I think there are wonderful benefits to it. And I was a little astounded that my children didn't really connect in the same way that I did. And I had a child who was indoors. But that child is amazing and thriving and engaged.
Yeah, and let me be clear that the last thing I'm trying to argue is that we need to unplug from technology and go back to nature. That's the opposite of what I'm arguing. What I'm really saying is that all the best studies we have right now suggest that we should be moving into a future that is rich in technology and nature. That if you think about our childhoods, we had much more time outdoors, so we were high in nature and low in technology. Now it's flipped. Now childhood is very high in technology, very low in nature. And the suggestion is we need to bring those back into balance, that kids need that physical outdoor running around time in addition to the time on screen. So I'm not trying to take us back to some bygone era, rather to move into a future that really hasn't been invented yet, but one that includes that natural time and the technology time.
Scott, you know, I think that if we're all being honest with ourselves, we can admit the ways that we like to, say, unwind after a long day. I can reason with myself that even though I want to go home and have a glass of wine, I'm going to feel so much better if I just get outside and go to Round Valley, which is our open space here, and ride my bike or take the dogs for a walk. So I know that. I know that my brain feels better, my body feels better. Children come home from being at school, sometimes 6 out of those 7 to 10 hours in front of a screen. And I saw my son, who's a senior and going through AP tests, come home, and he doesn't normally play with video games, but he came home from a really long AP test, and his way of unwinding was to sit in front of the video game and the screen for another couple of hours. And it occurred to me that it doesn't occur to him that he ought to just go outside and unwind that way. And my question is, how do we sort of spur that without just kicking our kids outside?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, when I go back to my childhood, I was literally kicked outside. It was like, yeah, you know, Saturday morning, go outside. I'm, you know, sometimes I think I imagine hearing the door lock behind me as I went outside. You know, I think that was, you just went out all day long and that's what you were doing. Clearly that isn't the case anymore. And particularly for kids who haven't had that outdoor exposure, they don't relate to the outdoors as a place to unwind or relax or have fun or be inspired. If you haven't had that experience, then being indoors where the outlets are and you can charge up your devices is the place where you want to be, because that's where everything is happening. So part of it is just exposing kids to it at whatever age they are. And it doesn't, you know, there's kids who've never been exposed to nature until they're 16 or 17 and still end up being fanatics about being outdoors and supporting that with others. There's a wonderful fellow in the Children in Nature Network named Juan Martinez who didn't even go out, and he was, you know, heading towards a gang lifestyle in L.A., East L.A., and he had a chance to go out into nature because he was sent to detention, to the Eco Club, and now he is, you know, out there representing North Face and National Geographic and the Children in Nature Network, getting other kids, and particularly kids of underserved kids of color, out into nature. So I think it can happen. In terms of how, I think partly it's just getting kids to do it. We're the parents,
yeah.
So we get to decide what kids do at some level, and we need to sort of make it part of kids' lives. I mean, we make literacy part of our kids' lives.
Mm-hmm.
We read to them every day, or we have them read. We see that as a really important value. We need to start thinking about connecting kids with nature in the same way, because the impacts on their health are potentially even, and their well-being are potentially even greater than that of literacy. But it's only going to happen if we do it. We have to schedule it, because kids' lives are very busy. We have to show the value of it, and we have to demonstrate it ourselves. If we as grown-ups aren't connected to nature, well, guess what? It's very unlikely that kids are either. And so one of the things I recommend to parents and grandparents and other caregivers is to find something outdoors that you love doing and take kids with you. And just by having that value, it's much more likely that they will pick that up. Certainly that was true of me and most people I know.
Yeah. Okay, you've inspired me. I'm going to haul my 17-year-old out to go for a walk in Round Valley with me and, you know, turn off the power or something.
When you get home, you're going to find the door locked and Jonas will be inside.
Yeah, he'll say, just stay there out there. Well, really coincidentally, we spoke last week on this program to Richard Louvre, the author of The Last Child in the Woods, and he's out with a new book called Vitamin N, N as in nature, and he gives you this ringing endorsement on the back cover of your book, How to Raise a Wild Child. And so it's really fortuitous and serendipitous that we're talking to you today. Richard Louvre said something, you know, because we were asking about, you know, here in Park City, we are pretty good about getting our kids outside. You know, they go skiing my question to him was about these organized, really structured ways of being outside. And he said, well, I'm not going to tell you not to put them on a soccer league or, you know, put them in ski lessons because that's great. They're outside. But I think that when you talk about creativity and when he spoke about creativity, it's more about unstructured time outside. Is that right?
Absolutely, and particularly for smaller kids, that one of the things that the psychologists tell us is that unstructured or free playtime is critical for mental development in early childhood, sort of, you know, birth to 6 years old. And a lot of kids just aren't getting that these days. And so that unstructured playtime is really important for growing minds. And it's something that we should be finding time for every day for those kids.
And Scott, you know, I saw a film at one of our film festivals, which we have here regularly, and it was kind of a little vignette on the nature kindergarten that takes place in Switzerland, I believe is where it was. And it was really amazing. They go every single day, year-round, into the wilderness, and it doesn't matter if it's raining, if it's snowing, and they have their kindergarten class in the wilderness. And one of the things that really astounded me was the parents would basically send them out the door, and the kids would walk to the bus station, get on the bus, and then have class, come back home on the bus on their own, walk to their homes, unlock the door, and let themselves in, and they're kindergartners. And I was kind of like, you know, number one, the safety, the trust in the safety of your child, that's a societal thing, and maybe Switzerland's a lot different than the U.S. in that respect. But also the competency of these kids to be able to do that and the trust that the parents had that the child would be able to do that, that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, you've hit it on a number of fronts there, Tim. We don't trust kids, and we don't let them take risks. And one of my things about, you know, connecting kids with nature and even just for a healthy childhood is that kids need to take risks because by the time they get to be teens, their brains are wired to take risks. And if we haven't shown them how to do that in a healthy, safe way, then they're not going to be healthy and safe in how they take risks. I walked to school as a kindergartner and let myself in after school, and it was completely normal at the time. Nowadays, there is this fear, and I get it. I have a 13-year-old daughter. I've experienced the same fear. Having said that, the chances of your child being abducted by a stranger are no greater now than in 1950 or 1960. Some people say they're less than they were at that time. So the fear, in some ways, is unfounded, and yet we have to acknowledge it. It's not something that's necessarily fully rational. And so what are the things that we can do to empower kids and make them, you know, feel confident and risk-taking? One of the ways is to do what I write about this in the book, is instead of being a helicopter parent where you're constantly hovering over your kid and driving them everywhere and watching every move they make and say, don't do this, don't do that, step back, be a hummingbird parent and be on the periphery and zoom in only when you're needed. And as kids grow up, increase the distance between you and them so that they get that feeling of confidence and they are able to sort of navigate their way through the world so that when they get to be teens, they'll make good decisions.
Wow, Scott, why didn't you come on our show 17 years ago when my son was a newborn? It's really great, and we could talk to you all hour, but of course, we're going to save you for the Summitland Conservancy breakfast a week from today. It's taking place at Deer Valley Resort. Go to wesavelands.org. You can get more information. You need to RSVP. They need to know numbers.
And I hear that it's selling out.
Selling out. Okay. Yeah. RSVP right now. We better get our RSVPs in.
Well,
I think it's during our show.
We'll be doing a radio show unless we want to do a live broadcast.
Yeah, that might not be a bad idea. I would love to have time to ask you about Dinosaur Train because the last time we spoke with you, we didn't get a chance to talk to you about that. Maybe you'll talk about it at the Summitland Conservancy breakfast.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I'll have a chance to do that there or not, but I'll tell you, I am thrilled to be coming back to Utah. I love the state of Utah. I love Park City, and to be able to go and speak with the Summitland Conservancy, a terrific group, is really a pleasure and an honor. So please, for all the listeners out there, if you'd like to come and join us, it would be great to see you there.
Dinosaur paleontologist, science communicator, passionate advocate for connecting people with nature. It's Scott Sampson. His book that he'll talk about next week is How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. Scott, it's been a pleasure speaking with you again.
Lynn, Tim, thank you very much. It's been great to have to be on the show.
All right. I love that guy. He got me so excited about the Nazuto Ceratops. And can I just tell you why?
I can't believe you can say that.
I know.
The Nazuto
Ceratops. It was 3 years ago. I'm still excited about it. Do you know what Nazu, you know, stands for? Latin?
I would think a nose.
Nose, yeah. And this dinosaur they found had this massive nose. That's why it got the name Nazuto Ceratops.
Is that the one that the Brontosaurus got renamed as? Or?
No, that was another one. But yeah, as it turns out, the Brontosaurus doesn't really exist. It's actually called something else because they name them for their features, like a big nose. So yeah, that was one of the things that all of the paleontological aficionados were so disappointed about. Disappointing kids all across the world. Okay, well, that was a great conversation. Again, it's May 11th, next Wednesday. Go to wesaveland.org to RSVP. And it's a breakfast, again, with the Summitland Conservancy. It's their annual conservation breakfast. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with Cycling Chicks.
You look like you're about to pop. Wow, your ankles are really swollen. You're just really emotional right now. People say a lot of dumb things to pregnant women. But here's a smart thing to say. Choose Park City Medical Center for your delivery. We offer 3 OBGYNs, a neonatal nurse practitioner, tele-NICU services, and all the pampering you and your baby deserve. Park City Medical Center. It's the smartest thing you can say to someone who's expecting. We're a nonprofit community hospital and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Hi, this is Sean Gobin, General Manager of Park Meadows Country Club and supporter of KPCW. Park Meadows is Park City's in-town country club, offering year-round amenities like Jack Nicklaus Signature Golf, Mountain Club at Deer Valley, social events, pool, and fitness center. Golf and social memberships are available at 649-2460 or parkmeadowscc.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, Debbie Drain is our next guest. She founded the group Cycling Chicks a few years ago. It's a for-profit group that supports nonprofit organizations like World Bicycle Relief in the cycling world. Their vision is to get more women on bikes, both locally and globally, and to connect women through cycling and all of their experiences. So not to be outdone by yoga clothing that we know is rather ubiquitous here in the Park City area.
Activewear.
Oh, yeah, activewear. Well, there is a cycling wear fashion show coming up on May 10th. It's from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Athletic Republic, and Cycling Chicks are putting it on. They've got lots of great apparel lines. Well, we'll let Debbie tell us all about it. Good morning to you, Debbie Drain.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for coming on. So I know that you know probably everything about all of the brands of cycling clothing. It amazes me. I do like the skorts. Yeah. So who will you have there?
Well, so we are going to have the three of the shops that are participating are going to be Jan's and White Pine and Storm Cycles down in Kimball Junction. And they are each going to bring in a few of their lines. And what we're trying to do is bring it all to one place so women can see what the array is, all the way from free ride downhill wear to road cycling to even urban. There are some really cool urban outfits.
That like club ride stuff?
Totally.
I love club ride.
And where you can wear your jeans with these special little padded underpants so that you can ride to Park Silly or, you know, Mountain Town Music or something, and or go to the grocery store and be a little more sustainable and free on your bike and look cute.
It's funny. I do have a jersey from Club Ride from about 5-8 years ago, and I think it's so cool that I never wear it cycling. I only wear it to work.
As activewear.
But it's nice how it all crosses the lines, the boundaries.
It does. And we thought that it would be a fun event to bring women together off the bike. We try to do events that bring women together off the bike, that they make connections so then they make new friends to ride in groups on the bike, because it's safer to ride together and it's just more enriching and fun. One of the other things we're going to highlight is there is a newer women's brand called Core, which in French means from the heart, and it is for endurance athletes. So they have outfits from active wear to triathlete wear to regular cycling wear. So they will be there as well, and we're highlighting them because they're a woman-developed, woman-owned company out of Santa Monica, California. And so they're in a few shops around, and so we're going to highlight them as well. And we're going to have lots of raffles. So you mentioned Club Ride. They're donating a couple pieces to be raffled off. So your tickets are only $10, and you get a raffle ticket with that, plus some appetizers, and many chances to win many nice things between arm sleeves, gloves, jerseys, and then Cycling Chicks has a line called the Cycling Chicks Collection. So part of our business is we are connecting women through cycling and empowering them. And the other passion for people around the world is they like to wear their passion. So we see that in football and collegiate sports, and they wear the hats and whatnot. So we've come out with, we've got flip-flops for after ride.
Cool.
We've got lots of jewelry that you wear, you know, you can wear it while you're cycling.
Yeah. How do you describe this? Because we saw your great photos of the earrings that you're wearing, for example. It's a wheel with spokes, but it's silver. It's, of course, it's radio, so we can't show pictures of it, but it's good stuff.
Yeah. So thank you. So if you look on our website's just being redesigned, and our group is free. So register, it's free, plus you get a discount at our store, always, as a cycling chick. And where this concept came up for the jewelry is my son. I have three boys that have gone through the school system here, and my middle son, Thomas Drain, in his jewelry class. He knew his mother so well, and this day is coming up on Sunday. 5 years ago, he gave me the pendant, the wheel, which is our ambassador wheel in our earrings and our necklaces. And he gave that to me as a Mother's Day gift because he understood how much his mother had a passion for cycling and I love to be on my bike. And so I was asked over the years a number of times, where can someone get that necklace? And I finally found a wonderful jeweler, Scott James in Heber, is creating these pendants for me.
Wonderful.
And Debbie, I'm wondering, because you're an umbrella organization that mm-hmm. is facilitating the connection of women to cycling, have you reached out to some of the other groups like the Nordic Betties or like Team Sugar? I know that that's a women's riding group. And I know that the Nordic Betties, one of the things that the Betties get very excited about is their outfit.
Yeah.
Every year they have a new outfit, and I like it. I wear one of their hats oftentimes
cool.
when I'm skiing, and we've had them in here. So are you making connections with
yes.
those groups that already exist in the community?
Yeah, so Tim, I'm glad you brought that up. So I don't want to quote-unquote reinvent the wheel. I want to be a resource hub for women and people in cycling. And so what we're trying to do last night, there's a new group called Women's MTB, run by a gal, Rachelle, out of Camas. And she had a trailside bike jam session. And so I went up and we kind of collaborated and explained kind of what we are. And so we're not meant to compete. We're meant to house all of that. So if you are in this area, hopefully you can find all the different cycling things that are available to you, not only in Park City, but globally. Part of the reason we revamped our website is last year we beta tested it and we had women from 6 continents and over 45 countries participating, giving us feedback. What are they interested in? What are they looking for? And we want women to be able to say, hey, I'm moving to Texas. What riding groups and people are there that I can instantly connect with because I feel very comfortable on my bike and I like that thread in a person. It's a common cycling thread. So if you go to Europe, you can also hopefully connect through our website to those resources and go ride this really cool, which I'm hoping to do this summer, 67-kilometer paved path in Germany. So
great.
We're just trying to tie that all together.
Yeah, just be a great resource. Well, good for you. Again, the website is?
Cyclingchicks.xyz. And that's important. It's not .com. .xyz is the new .com,
that's
according
new
to Wired Magazine.
Okay, interesting. So it's a fashion show.
I was just getting used to the .com.
I know. And the .net and the .org. I don't know. Maybe .net doesn't even exist anymore. It's the 2016 Women's Cycling Apparel. It's local bike shops, Jan's, White Pine, and Storm Cycles. It's all taking place May 10th. From 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Athletic Republic, and that's out by the Field House, Basin Rec. And you can RSVP and purchase tickets or show up at the door?
Both. So I just wanted to say you could either. We'd love it if you purchase it online because then we know numbers-wise for food. But you can buy them at the door, and we hope to see you there.
Okay. Debbie Drain, thanks so much for your time today. Good luck. And we'll be right back in just a moment. We're talking to Mark Wallen. He's the author of It Didn't Start With You. It's all about inherited family trauma when we return.
Hi, I'm Laura Falter, a longtime resident, parent of a Park City High School student, and office manager at Miller Orthodontics. We are proud supporters of KPCW. We also support the PCEF, which funds local school projects, and Running With Ed is coming May 21st. So don't forget to run with Ed. More information is at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. So we've been through cycling apparel. We've been through the wild child out in nature. And now, well, it's May and it's Mental Health Awareness Month. And we're happy to be joined by a pioneer in the field of inherited family trauma, Mark Wallen. He's written a new book. It's called It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are, and How to End the Cycle. He's the director of the Family Constellation Institute in San Francisco. He trains clinicians. He treats those struggling with depression, anxiety, phobias, chronic pain, obsessive thoughts, and more. Wallen will explain how we may not come into this world with a clean slate due to some inherited family trauma. Mark Wallen, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me, Lynn. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're really happy to have you. This is actually a topic that we have not spoken before about on this program, although we do speak a lot about mental health issues, especially during this month. But address that I said in the introduction. We may not come into this world with a clean slate due to inherited family trauma. Can you explain?
I can. When our parents experience a trauma, when our grandparents experienced, when we experience a trauma, it changes us. Literally, it causes a chemical change in the DNA, and it doesn't change the sequence of the DNA, but it changes how the genes function, sometimes for generations. So when we go to have children, they don't come in with a clean hard drive the way we'd like them to. There's a operating system that's already in place and one that contains the fallout from these traumas. So we can be born, or our kids can be born, with fears and feelings that don't always belong to them, belong to us, which is why I wrote the book, so we can make these links and then break the cycle.
So if we think about trauma, you know, some big things that we can, that just pop up in our mind would be something like the Holocaust or 9/11. And I'm wondering, you know, does it run up against, your religious beliefs, say, to actually sign on to this belief about inherited family trauma?
Say more about a religious belief.
Well, I guess I'm thinking about, you know, about just that notion that, you know, we come into this life with, another soul. Maybe we refer sometimes to people who are old souls or young souls. And that would suggest that you ascribe to some sort of religious belief or personal belief, even about reincarnation. So I'm wondering what your work, you know, how you separate it from something like reincarnation.
Well, I guess what I would say is I sit on a foundation of these scientific, academic studies that have been quite profound and disturbing at the same time, that show that an event like the Holocaust or an event like some mass trauma or massacre or genocide or even a smaller event, the loss of a child, the loss of one's home, the loss of one's parent, these things can transfer in a way that they're just beginning to study and come up with the evidence for, so that these changes in the DNA can affect our children in ways, and we can see remnants of the Holocaust. I'll tell you a story. I once worked with this man who, my goodness, he had anxiety attacks so severe that he couldn't leave his home. His words were, "I can't go anywhere new." He couldn't go to a new restaurant. He couldn't go to the neighborhood next door. And then he dropped the bomb, and he told me that 74 members of his family died in the Holocaust. Wow. Literally, they were taken somewhere new, forcibly from their homes to a concentration camp, and they were murdered. It's the first time he made the link. He knew he had this in his family, but he would black out whenever he'd leave the home. And then once he made this link and we did some work around it, he was able to take vacations. He was no longer a prisoner in his home.
Mark, I'm really fascinated by this connection that you're making, and I'm wondering about the evidence and how do you track that change in DNA, how the DNA performs, not how it gets resequenced, as you said, but, you know, how it functions when it's exposed to trauma. And I would assume that trauma could be in our daily lives when cortisol gets released and being that stress hormone, and if it's repeatedly released or released in inappropriate times or released, way more than you would hope it was released, that might start to have the same impact on your DNA.
Exactly. Exactly. So the studies on cortisol that are mind-blowing, there's this rock star neuroscientist from Mount Sinai in New York named Rachel Yehuda, who went against the notion that when we have a trauma, we have high cortisol. In fact, she found out that through these excessive incidents, we end up with a low cortisol pattern, and this creates those spikes. She studied a couple different groups. One group was Holocaust survivors and their children. One group was war veterans. One group was the children who were born at or near, well, to mothers who were pregnant at or near the World Trade Center when it was attacked during 9/11. And she found out that the children of these survivors had the same trauma symptoms as their parents, and specifically these low levels of cortisol, the stress hormone. And then she found that the just last year, she has this study. I think it's the first that you could really pin on humans. She found the exact same genetic changes in the exact same part of the gene, in the same gene. I think it's the FKB5 gene in Holocaust survivors and their parents, and their children, mm-hmm. which is pretty mind-blowing. There's been a whole lot of studies with mice that show a three-generation link. My goodness, if we have time, I'd love to talk about one of those studies.
And let me ask you just a follow-up question, and it's kind of a follow-up to what Lynn asked earlier, she beat me to this, but there's what I would call ancient practice, which has to do with reincarnation, soul retrieval in the shamanic sense. Buddhism talks about past lives and how we bring this karma and this experience with us into present day through many generations, you could say. And you have science now that is saying kind of the same thing. You're starting to prove out what I would say was ancient practice and ancient belief that Lynn called religious belief through science. And would you say that the science that you're exploring and doing inquiry around is legitimizing some of those ancient beliefs or delegitimizing them? Because there seems to be a convergence of the two, and I would think you could make a case for either one.
You know, we could even go back thousands of years to the Bible, where they talked about the sins or inequities of the parents. There's always been some understanding, but there's this one passage, I think, in Numbers that talks about where the children for 3 to 4 generations will experience or re-experience the events of their parents. Now, science, and here's a convergence that's quite interesting, because these studies are showing the same thing as in terms of 3 generations making it sort of astounding. I mean, so we look at a subject of reincarnation, which I can't really speak of, but there is a convergence in the sense of we don't come in with that clean hard drive, whether it's from past life events, I can't say, but certainly it's from the family history and the family that we're born into. One of the studies I found so fascinating is something they did with mice. They showed that fear, a response to fear, can be transmitted for 3 generations. And then they stopped it there. I'll explain how that worked. There's a study out of Emory Medical School where they took mice and they made mice afraid of a scent, a cherry blossom scent, by shocking the mice. So every time the mouse experienced this smell, it was then had an electric shock. And they proved that their receptors in the brain were larger, where it could smell that smell at less smaller concentrations. And then there were changes in the blood and the sperm. Well, the interesting thing is in the next generation, they took these male mice and they took the sperm into female mice that weren't shocked. And then in the next generation, they found that just by introducing the smell in the next generation, these mice were jittery and jumpy, and they were never shocked. Well, they did it in the third generation. And these mice in the second generation, they also had the enlarged receptors and the changes in the brain, blood, and the sperm. And then the same thing happened in the third generation, almost.
Wow.
Here's what happened. When they introduced the smell in the third generation, the mice were jumpy, they were jittery, they were freaking out without being shocked, but they didn't contain the same biological changes, which led the researchers, a man named Brian Diaz, to say, well, we can see it for 3 generations, but we have to question whether there's a 4th generation involved.
That is so fascinating. It's very sad, too, about torturing those little mice.
Yeah, absolutely.
But very interesting. Okay, so this leads well into my next question, which was going to be about treatment. So In that third generation or fourth generation, can we stimulate the mice by giving them some wonderful, pleasant experience, their favorite food or a nice little mouse massage when they smell the cherry blossom? Is that how you do it? I mean, we know so much about the brain's plasticity now and how much you can manipulate it. So I'm wondering if you did that same sort of thing with the fellow you were talking about with the 74 family members who died in the Holocaust.
Right, right. To heal, we need to have an experience that's powerful enough to override this trauma habit, this habit of feeling bad. Basically, when we have this new experience and we practice the new feelings of this experience, maybe there's breath involved, maybe there's movement, maybe there's doing something, we create these new neural pathways in the brain, and that's how we get to what the scientists are calling neuroplasticity, where our brains can change. So what I do in the book is several of my exercises, and this is the whole third part of the book, ask you to visualize doing something visceral, something you can feel in your body to create this experience, or saying something important to maybe those Holocaust members, or to your grandmother who's still alive or survived, or even the grandmother who didn't, or hearing something said to you. Do you know that the same regions of the brain are activated whether we visualize these things or actually living them? So in the book, I teach how to do this in a new way, so these new neural pathways are laid down in our brain. That's how we heal.
Wow. So, Tim, go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, well,
you have a question.
Again, this ties back to what I would call ancient practices in some respect, because a lot of people practice meditation when they're confronted with a challenge, a struggle, a traumatic event in their lives. Yoga is one of those practices. And then people like, well, I do both meditation and yoga, but I was going to say a lot of people like Lynn and I and this community, we exercise, we get out in nature, and we just had an interview on the connection to nature. We ride our bikes. We kind of balance the trauma with some other form of extreme reward, I would call it. And that, I think, is what you're talking about. You can heal that trauma through those sort of practices.
Exactly. In fact, they're showing that they did a study in Wisconsin at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and they talked about meditation, and they saw that it actually could affect gene expression. And boy, I'm going to butcher this, I think, if I try to remember the details, but I'm not even going to go there, but it did affect gene expression. Yeah.
So interesting. Okay, now one of my dearest friends is terrified of snakes. And she and I have been in Costa Rica several times, and she's just on edge the whole time we're there because she's scared of the dreaded terciopelo. But she passed on that fear to her daughter, which I was dismayed to see. But we do that. We pass on these fears to our children. And what's dawning on me now is perhaps she passed on that fear to her child through DNA versus conditioning. I mean, I'm sure it was conditioning. It was nurture as well, that she showed her fear of snakes to her child. But it all makes me think about how we might reprogram our children to not be afraid of the same things we're afraid of and that we just don't like that we're afraid of.
There's so many elements that go into the soup, so many ingredients. Epigenetics is one. Nurture would be one. The stories from our home. But the thing that excites me so much is even when these stories aren't told, even when we don't know the traumas, even when they're hidden, shrouded, kept secret, kept silent, they can have an effect on our children, which leads me to believe that something is being transmitted biologically. And then there are telltale signs, really, that we can hit a milestone in our life or a certain age, and it's as though we have this ancestral alarm clock inside us, that something is triggered For example, we get married, or we go to have a baby, or we move to a new place, or we get rejected by our first love. I once worked with a woman. She was consumed with anxiety. As soon as she became a new mother, and after asking her a few of the questions I outline in the book, we discovered that she had a terrible fear of harming her new baby. So I asked her, I said, did anyone in your family ever harm a baby? And she said, no. And then she said, oh my God, my grandmother, as a young woman, accidentally started a fire, and she couldn't get her newborn out, and her newborn died, and we were never allowed to talk about it. And she was going on. And in that moment, she made the link that she had somehow inherited this feeling from her grandmother. And yeah.
Wow, that is fascinating. The book is It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. And our guest is Mark Wolin. Accent on the second syllable. There we go. And I'm so glad we've spoken with you today. Tim, do you have another question there?
I'm so glad to be here.
Well, Mark, I'm wondering about, you know, you use the term gene expression, and it seems to me that gene expression could narrow the field of study or broaden it. And it feels like you're broadening it and making these connections through how to heal traumatic experience and how traumatic experience might be related to ancient practice. And that seems very broadening to me. But I would think that there might also be some people who would narrow and go, I'm going to study just gene expression and what happens in this mouse.
Yeah. I had no choice but to write this book. I saw too many things and too many clients, too many connections that were linked to traumas in the family, and then people getting better, feeling better once these traumas were unearthed or they were worked through. So I wrote this book. I just wanted to provide help for people who struggle with the effects of inherited family trauma and didn't know where to turn. We don't have a clue as to why we suffer, many of us, with these anxieties that come on suddenly, or fears we've had our whole lives, or depression we can't get to the bottom of. And I wanted to generate awareness, just as you're saying, in the therapeutic and medical communities about the impact of epigenetics, so we can see these studies, so we can see people go in a larger direction, and also practices like these become standard, so we know what to do when somebody comes to us and says, hey, I'm struggling in this way, but there's nothing in my childhood that points to it.
I think Ancestry.com ought to partner with you, Mark. They need you. I mean, it does make you want to. I don't know anything about my genealogy, really. And it does make you want to go back a little bit. It certainly sort of whets the appetite for knowing more about where you come from in your psyche.
So we have to. I always encourage people to shake that family tree and see what falls out. What family secrets have been hidden? What stories didn't get told? What traumas have never healed? It's really important that we know these things, Lynn and Tim, because our children could be unconsciously reliving elements that don't belong to them, just as we can.
Yeah.
And I always find that if we ignore the past, it can come back to haunt us, but if we explore it, we don't have to repeat it. We can break these destructive patterns.
Absolutely. What an interesting topic. Mark Wolin, thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
My absolute pleasure.
Again, the book is It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. And let's thank our underwriters today.
The doctors at the Park City Specialty Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, Park City Mountain, and Chateau Recovery.
We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank's Park City branch. We have been part of this community since 1998 as a local town bank. We take pride in giving back by supporting KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have branches in Heber City, Midway, and Park City.